Air New Zealand Flight 901, a McDonnell Douglas DC-10, departed from Auckland at 8:17 a.m. on a sightseeing trip to Antarctica with 257 people on board. While flying through Antarctica, the crew spotted a gap in the clouds and informed McMurdo ATC that they would descend into 2,000 feet to give the passengers a better look at the incredible landscape, but were never heard from again. What happened to Flight 901, and why didn't they follow up with air traffic control? Let's investigate the flight files of Air New Zealand Flight 901. Hello everybody, welcome back to the Flight Files. I'm your host Dan, and today we are talking about Air New Zealand Flight 901. But before we get into it, just want to mention that the Flight Files is on most social media platforms at the Flight Files, and also head over to theflightfiles.com. There'll be some blog posts, and that's the website for the podcast. But let's jump straight into Air New Zealand Flight 901. So, Air New Zealand is the flag carrier of New Zealand, founded in 1940, and it began serving some international routes in 1965. As of today, the airline offers flights to 20 domestic and 30 international destinations, which is an incredible amount of places. I've never flown in New Zealand, but it is always a country I've wanted to go to. So, maybe someday in the future, and if I do, I'll be sure to talk about my experience here on the podcast. So the plane in question with this incident is a McDonnell Douglas DC-10. It's a now retired three-engine wide-body jet airliner that was designed for long-range flights, being the successor to the very successful DC-8. It competed directly with some similar aircraft like the Airbus A300 and the Lockheed L1011 TriStar. So it's three-engine design. It had two turbofan engines mounted on the wings and a third at the base of the tail. The wide-body layout allowed for just two aisles, so the cabin was a lot more spacious than you find on some other planes. And McDonnell Douglas built 386 DC-10s total for airlines and 60 KC-10 extender versions for the US Air Force as refueling tankers. The refueling stuff, if you've ever seen the videos of planes, you know, more specifically like jets refueling mid-air, is really incredible, and the amount of precision that people, these pilots have is amazing. So, you know, hats off to them. So the DC-10's production ended in 1989, and most passenger DC-10s were mostly retired by 2014, but some continue as cargo planes. So the route in question was a sightseeing tour that was supposed to take passengers on a sightseeing tour over Antarctica, and it was scheduled to depart from Auckland International Airport at 8 a.m. and was scheduled to land back there at 9 p.m. with a stop at Christchurch International Airport in between. The tour was something that they had reintroduced. I'm not sure the ticket prices, but they would have been pretty expensive. But it was a non-stop flight that took off and landed at the same place, which is, you know, for most travel when you get on a plane is not typically something that happens. You normally end up in a different destination. But these tours proved really popular. It was a place that not many people, or very, very, very few people got to explore. So in New Zealand, introducing these flights was like a really big deal and very popular. But the crew on board, so there was 20 crew and 237 passengers. The pilot in command at the time of the incident was Thomas James Collins. He had a total flight hours of 11,151, with 2,872 of those hours being on the DC-10. In the last 90 days, he had also had 140 hours in the DC-10. The first officer, Gregory Mark Cassin, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, had a total flight hours of 7,934, with 1,361 of those being on the DC-10 and 127 hours in the past 90 days. So a really experienced crew, highly experienced and very capable crew. The flight engineer on the panel during the incident was Gordon Barrett Brooks, with a total flight hours of 10,886, with 3,000 on the DC-10 and 113 hours in the last 90 days on the DC-10 specifically. And the flight engineer who relinquished the panel during descent but remained on the flight deck was Nicholas John Maloney. They have a total flight hours of 6,468, with 1,700 of those hours being on the DC-10. And the other first officer that wasn't on the flight deck was Graham Neville Lucas. Not too sure about their flight hours, but they weren't involved or on the flight deck during the incident in question. So this incident is really, you know, like all of them, are really tragic. But this is particularly tragic because of how the experience was supposed to be. Like, it was, you know, you're not traveling from one destination to another. You're going on quite a rare occasion that people would have saved up so much for, and going to see a place that not many people would have ever been able to visit in their lifetime. So the two of the pilots attended a route qualification briefing, which consisted of an audio-visual presentation, a review of a printed briefing sheet, and a 45-minute flight in the DC-10 simulator, so that each pilot could familiarise themselves with the grid navigation procedures for the portion of the flight that was south of 60 degrees south latitude, and the visual meteorological conditions, which I'll refer to in the future as VMC, letdown procedure at McMurdo, which, as I mentioned in the intro, is the last place they communicated with. The briefing was completed 19 days prior to the scheduled departure date, so all of their information was pretty much up to date. The briefing gave details of the instrument flight rules, IFR, is what I'll refer to as that. But the instrument flight rules, basically, for those who don't know, means that they would fly with the assistance of their instruments, hence the name instrument flight rules. VFR is another alternative way of flying, which is visual flight rules, that's where you use specific landmarks and points of interest to navigate. So IFR is typically used for these bigger planes. VFR is typically for the smaller planes. And I believe above a certain altitude, I'm not entirely sure what the altitude is, but above a certain altitude, you have to fly IFR. So back to the briefing, sorry for the tangent. So the briefing gave details of the IFR route to McMurdo, which passed almost directly over Mount Erebus, which is a 12,450-foot high active volcano. And it's some 20 nautical miles prior to the most southerly turning point, Williams Field. It's also stated that the minimum instrument meteorological conditions, or IMC, altitude was 16,000 feet, and the minimum altitude after passing overhead McMurdo was 6,000 feet. If you were listening carefully in the intro, you would have heard that they went down to 2,000 feet. Quite a significant difference between 6,000. So, minimum altitude after passing overhead McMurdo was 6,000 feet, providing conditions were better than certain specified minima, well in excess of the standard VMC in New Zealand. On the day of the flight, the crew participated in a normal pre-flight dispatch planning, and at 19:17 hours on the 27th of November 1979, in New Zealand Flight 901, departed from Auckland Airport on a non-scheduled domestic scenic flight, which was planned to proceed via South Island, New Zealand, Auckland Island, Baleny Island, and Cape Hallett to McMurdo, Antarctica, then returning via Cape Hallett and Campbell Island to Christchurch, its first intended landing point. The flight was dispatched on an IFR computer stored flight plan route, and the flight deck crew consisted of the captain, two first officers, and the two flight engineers. Beside the 15 cabin crew, there was an official flight commentator on the flight who was experienced in Antarctic exploration. So as they were flying over the scenery, they would be able to give commentary on what the passengers were seeing. So the passenger load was reduced by 21 from the normal passenger seating allocation, which was a deliberate policy to allow movement in the cabin so people could view the scenery from different angles, basically. So in a discussion with McMurdo, the aircraft crew was advised that Ross Island was under a low overcast with a base of 2,000 feet and with some light snow and a visibility of 40 miles and clear areas, approximately 75 to 100 nautical miles northwest of McMurdo. So there was plenty of visibility, 40 miles of visibility and a low overcast, which the base was 2,000 feet. At approximately 1:45 in the morning, Scott Bass advised the aircraft that the Dry Valley area was clear, and that Iria would be a better prospect for sightseeing than Ross Island. So this was a slight change of plan to the route than they were briefed on. In response to the message that the area over the Wright and Taylor Valleys was clear, the captain asked the commentator if he did guide them over that way. So they were briefed on grid navigation. They practiced the flight for 45 minutes each in the simulator, and they did a whole briefing. And now this is being changed, and the commentator is being asked to guide them. Not a great setup when you have 200 plus people on board. So the commentator said that that'd be no problem, and asked the captain if they wished to head to that area at the time. The captain replied he would prefer here first. So the US Navy Air Traffic Control Center, or ATCC, which is dubbed MAC Center 3, suggested that the aircraft crew take advantage of the surveillance radar to let down to 1,500 feet during the aircraft's approach to McMurdo, and the crew indicated their acceptance of this offer. In the event, however, the aircraft was not located by the radar equipment prior to starting their descent, or at any other time, the aircraft crew also experienced difficulty in the attempts to make contact on the very high frequency of VHF radio telephone. Their distance measuring equipment as well didn't lock onto the McMurdo Tactical Air Nav System, or the TACAN, for any useful period. So the aircraft was mainly relying on their high frequency radio telephone during the latter part of its flight for communication with the ATCC. So not only were they having issues locking onto the radar, they were having issues with communication, and they were flying. They were being guided by the commentator to a place that wasn't planned as part of their route. So the area, which was approved by the operator for VMC descents below 16,000 feet, was obscured by cloud. And while they were approaching the area, and the crew elected to descend in a clear area to the north of Ross Island in two descending orbits. So the first one was to the right, and then the second was to the left. So the descent orbit is so that you can sort of descend in a contained area rather than descending constantly. And we'll get to that later as to why. So although they requested and were granted clearance from MAC Center to descend from 10,000 to 2,000 feet and proceed visually to McMurdo, they only descended to 8,600 feet before it completed a 180 left turn, and during which it descended further to 5,700 feet. The aircraft's descent was then continued to 1,500 feet on the flight planned track back towards Ross Island. Now, obviously, MAC Center gave them clearance to descend to 2,000 feet, and they had descended through 2,000 feet down to 1,500 feet, which is it's not good. Went against the approval that the ATCC gave them. So there's some issues with that. And unfortunately, due to this, after completion of their final descent in New Zealand, Flight 901 collided with Ross Island. So the aircraft's ground proximity warning system operated correctly prior to impact, and the crew responded to this equipment's warning by the engineer calling off two heights above ground level, 500 and 400 feet. The captain called in for go-around power. So basically what this means when they call for go-around power is your throttle gets pushed to full, the engine spool up for full power, and it's designed so that you can take back off, get up into the air quickly. So a go-around is perfectly safe when you're landing at an airport. It happens for many reasons. People tend to panic when it happens, but it's absolutely fine to experience. It's basically just a safety precaution, and that's what they tried to do here, because their systems would tell them that they were only 500 and then 400 feet off the ground. So the aircraft's three engines were at a high power setting, and the aircraft had started to rotate up upwards in pitch immediately prior to impact with Ross Island. So the aircraft collided with an ice slope on Ross Island and immediately started to break up. A fire then started on impact, and the fire raged in the cabin area after the section came to rest. The incident occurred at 10 to 1 in the morning and at an elevation of 1,467 feet. The cockpit voice recorder, or the CVR, and the digital flight data recorder, the DFTR, or the black box, established that the aircraft was operated operating satisfactorily, and the crew were not incapacitated, prior to the accident. So, after the incident, at 2 p.m., the United States Navy released a situation report stating that in New Zealand, Flight 901 had failed to acknowledge radio transmissions, and that they were sending out aircrafts for a search and rescue effort. The data that was gathered at 3:43 p.m. were added to the situation report, and it stated that the visibility was 40 miles, and also that six aircraft had been launched to find the Air New Zealand flight. As I mentioned earlier, Flight 901 was due to arrive back at Christchurch at 6:05 p.m. for a stopover to refuel and change crew before returning back to Auckland. So 50 passengers, roughly, were supposed to get off at Christchurch as well, and airport staff initially told the families that were waiting that the flight being slightly late was not unusual, but as time went on, it was obvious that something had happened and something had went wrong. At 9 p.m., about half an hour after the plane would have run out of fuel, Air New Zealand informed the press that it believed that the aircraft was lost, and rescue teams had searched along the assumed flight path but found nothing. As mentioned earlier, they had strayed off the flight path that was planned due to visibility being better in a different area. And then at 5:01 in the morning, the US States Navy aircraft discovered an unidentified debris on the side of Mount Erebus. When they discovered the wreckage, obviously no survivors were found. So at the point of impact, everyone had perished on board, which is terrible. And then around at 9 a.m., which was 20 hours after the crash, the helicopters with search parties managed to land on the side of the mountain, and they confirmed that the wreckage was indeed Flight 901, and all 237 passengers and 20 crew had perished. The vertical stabilizer section of the plane, with the logo clearly visible, was found in the snow, and any remains were flown back to Auckland for identification. The Flight 901 crashing into one of the most isolated parts of the world, despite them crashing there, evidence was extensive. So both the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder were in working order and were able to be deciphered. And there was so many photos, including video from the moments before crash, were available. Because it was a sightseeing flight, a lot of passengers were carrying cameras, which most of the film was able to be developed. So the accident report, which was compiled by New Zealand's Chief Inspector of Air Incidents, was released on the 12th of June 1980, and it cited that pilot error was the principal cause of the accident, and it attributed blame to the decisions of Collins to descend below the minimum altitude level and to continue at that altitude when the crew was unsure of the plane's position. So I think one thing that's not mentioned, I didn't mention earlier, with it being Antarctica, and I did mention it slightly, that it was covered in snow. If everything looks the same, so despite there being visibility for 40 miles, if everything looks white because of the snow, there was no way for them to differentiate between just open land that's beneath them and a very bright white mountain in front of them. So likely the reason for the crash is that they couldn't differentiate between land and mountain. So the minimum altitude that they were prohibited to descend below was 6,000 feet, and they were given approval to descend to 2,000 feet, in a different area. So even under good weather conditions, 6,000 feet is the minimum. And there was a combination of factors that led the captain to believe that the plane was over the sea, and the previous Flight 901 pilots had regularly flown over the area to give passengers a better view. So this is something that has been done previously, something that was done successfully. Unfortunately, this was probably not done below 6,000 feet previously. So the photos of people going over that area appeared in New Zealand's travel magazine, but whether they actually allowed them to descend below 2,000 feet is unknown. So in response to the demand from the public, the New Zealand government announced a further commission into the incident, and that was going to be performed by the Royal Commission. And the Royal Commission was initially handicapped because the deadline was really short, set for the 31st of October 1980, and it was extended four times after that. So their report, which was released on the 27th of April 1981, actually cleared the crew of blame for the incident. The single dominant and effective cause of the crash was Air New Zealand's alteration of the flight plan waypoint coordinates in the ground navigation computer without advising the crew. The new plan took the aircraft directly over the mountain rather than along its flank due to whiteout conditions. Again, what I explained earlier, the crew were unable to visually identify the mountain in front of them. So they may have experienced a rare meteorological phenomenon, which is called sector whiteout. And basically what this is a visual illusion, like I explained earlier, of a flat horizon far into the distance. A very broad gap between cloud layers appeared to allow a view of the distant Ross Ice Shelf and beyond. And Mahon, who was running this inquiry, noted that the flight crew had thousands of hours of flight time between them. So a very experienced crew, And they had considerable experience with the accuracy of the aircraft's navigation system. So Mahon also found that the pre-flight briefings for previous flights had approved descents to any altitude that was authorized by the USATC at McMurdo. And the Radio Communications Center at McMurdo had indeed authorized Collins to descend to 1,500 feet below the minimum safe level of 6,000 feet. In his report, he also found that the airline executives and senior pilots had engaged in a conspiracy to whitewash the inquiry and accused them of an orchestrated litany of lies by covering up evidence and lying to investigators. Mahon also found that in the original report, Chippendale had a poor grasp of the fly-in involved in jet airline operation, as he and the New Zealand CAA in general was typically involved in investigating simple light aircraft crashes. So Chippendale was New Zealand's chief inspector of air accidents. So that's who Chippendale refers to in this section. So Chippendale's investigation techniques were revealed as lacking in rigor, which allowed errors and avoidable gaps in knowledge to appear in reports. And consequently, Chippendale entirely missed the importance of the flight plan change and the rare meteorological conditions of Antarctica. Then Mahon goes on to say that if the pilots had been informed of the flight plan change, the crash would have been avoided, which is a big thing to say, that the crash would have entirely been avoided if they were informed of the flight plan change. And this is a inquiry that the New Zealand government commissioned. So this is as accurate as can be. It's really sad. And even worse when it came out that the pilots were to blame, like the crew were to blame. And I'm sure there was so much backlash in the news at the time about these pilots and obviously their family had lost people, right? Their family had lost their family, as well as all the other people on board. And their names were probably being dragged through the mud, which is not fair. When Chippendale, Ron Chippendale came out and said that pilot error was the cause of the crash. So hopefully Mahon's report cleared their name, and in the news it was cleared as well. Their families could have a little bit of peace knowing that it wasn't actually their fault. But like all incidents, it's terrible. It's really sad, and it's even worse when it was pretty much confirmed that it could have been avoided. So I'm not sure if these flights still happen today. I imagine they would have stopped after this flight, but I'm not sure if they've started them back up. It's an interesting experience, I would imagine, to see a place of the world that's, you know, very, very distant, very out of the way, and it must be pretty spectacular to see. And I'm sure, like, as time goes on, we'll have more experiences like that. We already have people who are paying to go up into space or low Earth orbit to see Earth from outside of its, like, you know, off land, right? So I'm sure a flight like this, if it hasn't already come back, will come back eventually. But it's a ongoing reminder that integrity in aviation is super important, and you know, these pilots were really experienced. Between them, they had like over 30,000 hours. That's incredible experience, and that's without the other first officer whose flight hours I wasn't able to find. So I was glad to find out that they were exonerated from blame. And as always, as I like to mention, that aviation is the safest form of transport. So when you get on those planes, don't be scared. And, you know, remember that you only see the bad in the news. We spoke about Boeing in a previous episode, and obviously they're going through a lot of trouble at the moment. But ultimately, there are still Boeing planes that are flying, taking off, landing every single day. So don't be scared to get on the flight. It'll be fine. You only hear about the bad. You never hear about every plane that lands. But thank you for listening. This was a solo episode. There'll probably be more of these to come as we move forward. So let me know on social media if you like these different style of videos. We just to remind you that our social media is The Flight Files, or at The Flight Files on every platform. And you can also check out the website, theflightfiles.com. Thank you for listening. I've been your host, Dan, and I hope that you join me for the next episode of The Flight Files.